Welcome to the K-12 Breakdown with Brooks and Bronder, your daily podcast of the top education headlines from across the web. And now, here are your hosts, Mike and Susie.
Good morning. Today on the Breakdown, we're covering a wide range of stories ranging from school budgeting to race and identity, and we'll go deep on articles about autism, communication strategies, the emphasis of music in schools, and district drug overdose interventions. As always, you can find these stories and more on k12leaders.com/breakdown, where we read the education news so you don't have to. I'm Mike Bronder, and I'd like to introduce my co-host, Ms. Susie Brooks.
Good morning, Michael. Thank you for giving us the overview this morning. Sounds like a great collection that we have to share with our listeners. Word of the day today coming at us from the Learning Network is eventually, but it's eventuality. And it's been appearing in 15 articles on the New York Times over the past year. I'm surprised it hasn't been in there more times. And you might also want to check out on the Yahoo search results has some information on there that they're calling for, advocates calling for more money for K-12 education. I'd say that that's probably in a lot of articles floating around on the internet. But also the ones that have really stuck out to me that I wish I had more time to read to you today is one coming at you again from the Learning Network, where teens are weighing in on what teenage bullying is like today. I am very glad that A, I am not a teenager, and B, that I am not raising teenagers anymore. But if you know one, you love one, you work with one or more, then you will definitely want to check that out and become up to date on the many ways in which bullying happens. These days, it's a scary world to live in, and a very difficult one to raise them in. So be sure to check that out. And what are you looking at this morning, Michael?
Right. So Susie, you're right. There are a lot of articles this morning on budgeting conversations at the state level. You can find those on k12leaders.com/breakdown. I'm sure your state's mentioned. Also on the breakdown, we're linking to articles from district administration has a great article on overcoming facilities challenges. There are other articles coming across the feed about, again, from the Learning Network, Susie. They have some great resources on checking your watch and how to get students to engage in conversation around how they rush through their days. District communications platforms, I think, is one that you're going to dive into. And then we have other articles from Personalizing History for More Impactful Student Learning on eSchool News, written by Heather Bassett and Cinda Wood. Some tech advice on unfreezing devices from Tech and Learning, one of our partners. You can find them here on K-12 Leaders, and you can see all of these articles and more at k12leaders.com/breakdown. One that I would like to dive into, Susie, if you don't mind, is news out of Washington State and a bill requiring schools to carry overdose reversal medication. That is headed into debate. The Washington House and Senate lawmakers have unanimously passed a bill requiring all public, charter, and certain tribal schools in the state to carry naloxone, an opioid overdose reversal medication, also known by the brand name Narcan. This is in the WashingtonStateStandard.com and is linked on k12leaders.com/breakdown. Senate Bill 5804, sponsored by Senator Patty Kuderer from Bellevue, will move to Governor Jay Inslee's desk, where he is expected to sign it into law, Kuderer's office said. "We all wish we weren't here as a nation, but we are," Kuderer said. "This bill is about saving lives." Washington has seen a dramatic increase in opioid overdose deaths among young people, particularly due to fentanyl, a cheap and devastating drug. According to the State Department of Health, rates of opioid-related fatalities among adolescents ages 14 to 18 surged almost threefold from 2016 to 2022, The agency says the increase can largely be attributed to fentanyl. Current Washington law requires school districts with over 2,000 students to carry at least one box of naloxone in each of its high schools. But students at Lake Washington High School who brought the bill to Kutterer told lawmakers during committee hearings that over half of the state's districts have fewer than 2,000 students. The group of students said in a statement that they believe the legislation will mark a critical turning point in protecting students from the opioid epidemic. State Bill 5804 is part of a larger effort by Washington lawmakers to combat youth opioid use and the broader opioid epidemic. The State Department of Health in January also said they would offer every high school in Washington a box of naloxone for free. Despite being divided along party lines on many things, we're unified in this front, said Rep. Murray Levitt from University Place during a bipartisan press conference on the opioid epidemic. I think particularly notable in this story is that this is a student-led bill. So congratulations to the students in Washington for speaking up and advocating for themselves. And I'm glad that they were able to see their efforts come to some fruition, Susie.
Excellent. Yeah, that's a great one. It's funny because one of the articles I missed when I first started zooming through them at the very bottom here on k12leaders.com/breakdown is one that was put out by Skyla Laird from the 74 South Carolina bill targets youth vaping epidemic, which ties in a little bit with what you're talking about. In Oconee County, dozens of illegal e-cigarettes are confiscated from students weekly, tallying to potentially thousands in the past 3 years, estimates School Security Director Evie Hughes says, I don't believe you can go into a bathroom in a middle or high school and not get a vape, Hughes told the South Carolina Daily Gazette. So, it's amazing what we're seeing in high schools across the nation. So I'd say that pair of articles is something that our listeners may want to dig a little bit deeper into on the breakdown. This morning, yep. Go ahead.
No, that's true. I mean, there are several articles coming across over the last weeks around this, and you can find details to them on k12leaders.com/breakdown. What else is catching your eye this morning, Susie?
There were a pair of articles this morning that came out of the 74, both of them written by the same author, Beth Hawkins, very similar topics. One of them, America's most popular autism therapy may not work and may seriously harm patients' mental health. The blurb goes on to say, in 1987, a prominent University of California, Los Angeles psychologist published the culmination of his life's work and spurred headlines across the globe. Ole Ivar Lovis, I am sorry about mispronouncing your name, I'm sure I did, claimed that delivering a new therapy one-on-one for 40 hours a week had made 9 of 19 autistic students indistinguishable from their typically developing peers. And it goes on to talk about his subjects and those results. So I started to look at that article, but then I realized that there was another article by the same author on the same day from the 74 that I wanted to read in its entirety on our broadcast today, because it talks about kind of the civil rights of the people with disabilities and prohibiting discrimination in education. So I think that it will resonate with a lot of our readers. So I'm going to dive deeper into that one. And like I said, it's on the 74. It says a generation of disabled adults say that, oh, and I didn't even read the title, no more cures, no more fixes, how autistic leaders are changing the therapy debate. A generation of disabled adults say the premise underlying controversial behavior interventions to extinguish autistic traits is a deal breaker. 50 years ago, Congress passed the first law recognizing the civil rights of people with disabilities, prohibiting discrimination in education, transportation, access to public buildings and facilities. The Rehabilitation Act of 1973 set the stage for a host of legal protections. The 1975 passage of what is now known as the Individuals with Disabilities in Education Act established that every child, no matter how profound their needs, had a right to a free and adequate public education. In 1990, the Americans with Disabilities Act enshrined in law the right of people with disabilities to enjoy the fullest possible access to jobs, housing, and other pillars of life of dignity. And other pillars of a life of dignity. It meant that they were entitled to have a wheelchair ramp, a sign language interpreter, or other forms of assistance that would help them literally take a place at the tables where discussions of their needs were underway. Once included, people with disabilities pushed for a shift in thinking about how disability issues should be framed. In the past, the non-disabled people making decisions about how to meet the needs of people with disabilities employed what was often described as the medical model. The goal was to determine how to make up for physical, neurological, and intellectual deficits. Today, many disabled people would prefer what they call the social model, which instead identifies systemic barriers to participation in society, including ignorance, bigotry, and societal exclusion. The new goal is to make the environment more inclusive and hospitable to everyone. Nowhere has this change of attitude been more apparent than among autistic people. Autism, once blamed on poor parenting, is now understood in scientific terms to be a neurotype, not a condition resulting from a lack of anything physical or psychological, but a body and brain wired differently. Not only is it impossible to fix or cure autism, many autistic adults say it's not desirable. Autists have abilities that non-autistic people don't, and they are demanding a voice in how their own needs should be met. As a motto of the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network puts it, nothing about us without us. One flashpoint is applied behavior analysis, one described as the gold standard intervention for autism. Developed and nurtured into a multi-billion dollar industry by neurotypical researchers, parents, and service providers, ABA is now the chief therapy recommended when a child is diagnosed as autistic. Created in the 1980s, ABA aimed to condition autistic children to act as neurotypically as possible using punishments, including slaps, electric shocks, and withholding of food. Many parents saw its goals as desirable. Autistic youngsters can exhibit behaviors that can exhaust caregivers and teachers and make friendships difficult, if not impossible. Over the years, ABA has moved away from physical punishment, and many families credit the therapy with helping their child make miraculous strides. But many adult autists believe its more recent methods of withholding toys, treats, and attention, and physically compelling patients to make eye contact, which some find extremely painful, can be extremely damaging to their mental health. Some who have become autism researchers themselves have documented harms ranging from dramatically higher incidences of PTSD to a debilitating focus on compliant behavior that impairs participants' ability to act independently as adults. And research from, among other sources, a multidisciplinary team of university scholars and the U.S. Department of Defense, which ensures thousands of autistic military dependents who have undergone the treatment, have found the evidence base for ABA thin and of poor quality. This particularly troubling to critics of ABA, as it is often the only therapy offered to parents, to the exclusion of other possibly more effective treatments. During a 2020 address of Drexel University, Julia Bascom, until recently the network's executive director, offered an example of how changing the prism through which disability is viewed clashes with the most prevalent therapies and services. In the medical model, autism means that my senses are disordered. If that sound hurts me, the solution is to fix how my brain is processing those sounds, or teach me how to get used to it, or at least how to hide my discomfort. The problem is located in my body. In the social model, the solution to auditory overload is to give me a pair of headphones. The social model also allows us to acknowledge complexity and that the same painful sensitivity might also make my experience with music uniquely transcendent. The same thing that makes wool unbearably itchy might also make water between my fingertips more soothing than anything else in the world. Maybe not all those things need a solution. Maybe autism might need a more nuanced approach than has traditionally been offered. There are also concerns that trying to alter a fundamental aspect of a person's identity, especially without their consent, as in young children, violates their rights. An assistant professor who teaches bioethics at the University of Pittsburgh School of Nursing, Daniel Wilkenfeld, was diagnosed as autistic after an evaluation of one of his children, a common occurrence. ABA's goal of trying to train youngsters to act in ways found societally acceptable is unethical, he wrote in a 2020 paper published in the Kennedy Institute of Ethics Journal. Autism advocates are fully justified in their concerns, wrote Wilkenfeld and co-author Allison McCarthy. The rights of autistic children and their parents are being regularly infringed upon. Specifically, we will argue that employing ABA violates the principles of justice and non-maleficence and, most critically, infringes on the autonomy of children and, when pushed aggressively, on parents as well. I really encourage you to read this whole article. I know it's a long one. It wraps up to say, indeed, one really rarely discussed aspect of attempting to replace autistic traits with more normal ones is that it can wipe out the ways in which neurodivergent people like to socialize and play. Stims, like self-soothing rocking, hand flapping, and vocalizations that some autistic people use to cope with overstimulation can also be expressions of joy, and ABA discourages both. Would you tolerate being told that the proper way to express happiness is to spin in circles, but then be punished when you smiled or laughed instead? Chloe Everett, a psychology student at the University of North Carolina, Asheville, who experienced ABA as a child, asked in a regional TEDx talk. I don't think so. I think that this article can really make you think about the ways in which we are supporting our neurodivergent students and the ways in which we're advancing our treatment and our supports for them. So this article and the other article by the same author, I think, are both great reads.
That's fantastic. Thank you, Susie, for that deep readout of clearly a very thoughtful and well-researched article on the 74. And it poses a lot of good questions, which we'd love to have you discuss on k12leaders.com/breakdown. You can find a link to that article and the ensuing discussion. Your voice matters, and we're here to amplify that. So we'd encourage you to come and join us in that conversation. So thanks for that, Susie.
You're welcome.
Couple other stories as we go through the wire. Following up on a story from last week in Brockton, Massachusetts, where there are both really grim budget situations, some drama around the superintendent who retired, and a lot of stories about violence in the school buildings. We have a new update from Boston.com. The link is on k12leaders.com/breakdown. And this just highlights that the Brockton School Committee wants mentors to go into school to ease violence and support students. What is it going to take for someone to make a decision about keeping our staff and students safe? An advocate asked school committee members. And there's a lot of, there's some interesting details here. But towards the end of a two-hour school committee meeting, school committee member Joyce Asick prompted the discussion about security personnel at Brockton High, which is the largest high school in the state. I've gotten a ton of emails from people offering their services, but it's a business and they want to get paid, and we don't have the money, Asick told her colleagues. So school committee member Tony Rodriguez then moved to allow for acting superintendent James Cobbs to get into an agreement and talks with community engagement groups and volunteers to come into their schools and help volunteer to support teachers and students. And he says that those volunteers could be in mentorship roles. So that story and more is at k12leaders.com/breakdown. And I'd encourage you to come in and join the conversation. Additionally, we have more stories about voters wrestling to support schools or wrestle with, against property tax increases. The budget issue is in plain sight as you scroll through the feed this morning. And Susie, if you don't mind, I'd like to go into one final story here about the Great Equalizer. This is from District Administration. And let's see, District Administration. Oh, wait, no, we have a couple stories because we have some communication to talk about, too.
We do.
So why don't you take that one first, Susie, the communications one, and we'll wrap up with the Great Equalizer.
Absolutely, I'd be happy to. The story is coming at us from eSchool News, and it's written by Dr. Matthew X. Joseph, who is actually my co-author. We've written a book together, and you'll be seeing a new version of that story coming out probably this summer, A Mentor's Mindset, Your Pathway to Professional Growth in Education. But this article is how district communication platforms bridge communities. In today's globalized world, district communication platforms play a critical role in keeping school and home connected. In an increasingly interconnected world, it's more important than ever to have effective communication within your diverse school community. Communication plays a pivotal role in fostering a collaborative environment, ensuring the well-being of students, and promoting a culture of continuous improvement. Communication impacts all of your stakeholders, and when parents are involved in their children's schooling, academic achievement, school engagement, and motivation all improve, according to the American Psychological Association. One of the most significant barriers to successful integration of newcomers into communities is language. Schools have a twofold challenge. Newcomers struggle to understand and be understood, and schools grapple with the means to effectively communicate with them. This is where a communications platform like Blooms can make a profound impact. By offering translation services in more than 133 languages, Blooms dismantles these barriers, ensuring that important information reaches everyone in a language they select. This feature is particularly crucial in educational settings where parents' engagement in their children's schooling is pivotal. With Blooms, parents who are not proficient in the local language can receive updates, participate in discussions, and contribute meaningfully to their children's education. I'll take a quick pause here just to mention also that there are lots of communication platforms that have these abilities to translate for families and their students, which is awesome. There are 97 languages spoken in the Round Rock Independent School District in Texas. Before Blooms, we would have send out posts, calendars, and alerts, and put the information in our website for parents to change into a different language. But there weren't many available other than Spanish, says Bertha Benedict, Director of Bilingual and ESL Programs. ESSA requires me to do a parent engagement and go above and beyond. I have to communicate with parents. Blooms lets me do that. Communicating in your native language is deeply empowering. It's not just about understanding words. It's about connecting with those words on a cultural and emotional level. Blooms acknowledges this by providing a platform where every individual feels seen, heard, and valued. This inclusivity goes a long way in fostering a sense of belonging among newcomers, making their transition into a new community smoother and more comfortable. Furthermore, when the local community members witness the effort to accommodate different languages and cultures, it cultivates an atmosphere of empathy and respect. Such an environment encourages deeper and more meaningful interactions, paving the way for a cohesive and supportive community fabric. While newcomers strive to adapt to their new surroundings, the host community also needs to extend support and understanding. Blooms facilitates this mutual effort by ensuring that language does not become an impediment to participation. Whether it's parent-teacher meetings, community events, or local announcements, the availability of multiple languages ensures that everyone can be an active participant. This not only boosts the confidence of newcomers, but also enriches the community's cultural tapestry. When people from diverse backgrounds share their perspectives and experiences, it leads to a more vibrant, dynamic, and innovative community. Joseph Matina is a principal of PS023 Carter G. Woodson Elementary School in Brooklyn, New York, a Title I school with every student below the poverty line. "We struggle with parent engagement and involvement," he says. "Lots of our students are in temporary housing. Parents come from different backgrounds and have different capabilities around using technology, and they don't go through backpacks and folders. We wanted it to be easy for us and for the parents to interact. With Blooms, we can notify parents immediately if we can schedule messages to go out a week or two in advance. Parents' involvement is more favorable now than it was 5 years ago, and a lot of that has to do with Blooms." Kathy Daniels, a former principal at Waters Elementary School in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, agrees that Blooms helped her teachers connect with all families. "Teachers can send out beautiful pictures and video clips to parents about what's happening and share inside classroom experience. We've never had the opportunity to get pictures to parents as quickly as with Blooms does." In today's globalized world, platforms like Blooms plays a critical role in keeping school and home connected. As we move forward, the lessons districts learn from communications platforms will shape the future of community engagement and integration, making our communities more connected, empathetic, and inclusive. I think that those platforms in districts make a huge difference, especially connecting with our newcomer populations. I think that Matt did a great job of being able to focus on that in his article.
Thanks for that, Susie. And, you know, and it's a new term to me, newcomer, that just came up in the last couple of months in conversations we've had on K-12 leaders. And it seems like a real healthy way to think about new members of our community, wherever they come from. And really interesting in that article was, the idea, it's sort of like this inherited culture we have around the backpack. And, you know, we have parents who know that they have to go through their student's backpack sort of as a regular part of the after school sort of wind down, right? But but if you're new to the U.S. education system, how would you know that you're supposed to like go through and actually dig through your child's, school supplies to find communications from the school district, you know, or the teacher, right? So, you know, real subtle sort of, component to the dynamic there. Mm-hmm. So thanks for that. There's also, another nice story here. This one also from district administration and Matthew Zelaznik, who's written some great articles that we've highlighted on k12leaders.com/breakdown. And we'll wrap up today with this story about Superintendent Amy Carter and her embrace of music as a high priority in her school district. So Superintendent Amy Carter couldn't afford an instrument in high school, so she had to find another way into the band. She joined the Flag Corps and became its captain and got a band scholarship to Mississippi Valley State University. There, the band director inspired her to begin learning to play the saxophone. Carter describes herself as a shy child who, perhaps for that very reason, was often chosen as a narrator for high school plays. At first, she thought the drama teacher was picking on her by forcing her into the limelight. She said, "I see something in you you don't see in yourself yet." Carter recalled, "Music and the arts in general, that is where I found my voice as a kid." Finding that voice is a gift that she has long been passionate about passing on to her students in Mississippi's Meridian Public School District, says Carter, who received the Save the Music Foundation Award for Distinguished Support of Music Education at last month's AASA, the Superintendent Association's conference. She realized early on as a teacher that music and the arts are productive ways to channel younger students' boundless energy and engage them further in their learning. As an administrator, Carter convinced a previous superintendent to place a music teacher in every elementary school. As superintendent, she has continued to invest heavily in young, energetic middle school band directors to bolster feeder programs into Meridian's high schools. A partnership with the Save the Music Foundation ensures that all students have access to instruments. The arts, music, represent opportunity, voice, doors that normally would not be open to kids from impoverished backgrounds, she asserts. It means so much more than let's just put an instrument in a kid's hand or let's give kids a chance to sing. And what I love is children are starting to see it. Meridian's musical and theater performances are now as well attended as athletic events. Carter has also expanded professional development to help teachers embed music and the arts in subjects across the curriculum. It's the great equalizer, she notes. For kids from impoverished backgrounds, school is a safe place. Even when you look at the challenges students face today in any part of the country, arts and music can be an escape for a kid. Her efforts to embed music and the arts throughout her district's curriculum are paying off in even bigger ways: improved grades, higher attendance, and greater student engagement. Very few students who participate in band get into trouble in school, and their attendance and grades are better. And an increasing number of Meridian graduates are earning college arts and music scholarships, she notes. When Carter became superintendent in 2016, Meridian was designated as a low-performing failing district. Now the system is right on the cusp of being recognized as high-performing. When I started, it was, you have to get test scores up, you have to get test scores up, she concludes. Ultimately, it became, if I do what's right for students, if we create opportunity for them, voice for them, help them see their potential, the test scores will come up. That's a nice story.
And I like that one.
I love that they're getting the same attendance at arts events as they are at sports events. I'm a big fan of both. We, you know, love our football team here in my local community, and the school plays are just as much fun. So that's a great story.
That was an awesome one. That was one that I almost picked. We're going to have to start fighting for stories in the morning now. That was a good one. I think that that probably wraps it up for us this morning. We're at the end of another K-12 breakdown with Brooks and Bronder, where we read out and break down the top education headlines from across the web every weekday morning so that you can stay up to date with everything affecting K-12 education. So we hope that you come on to K-12 leaders and your perspective matters. And this podcast is all about fostering a vibrant community for K-12 leaders. We look forward to tomorrow morning when we share out what's new then. So I'm Susie Brooks, and
I'm Mike Bronder. Thank you all for joining. We'll see you tomorrow.